From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the slums of Beverly Hills. We talk with Tamara Jenkins about her new movie, which is loosely based on her teenage years when her father was close to broke and the family lived in dumpy apartments in a high-class zip code so the kids could go to good public schools. Also, a concert and interview with pianist and singer Daryl Sherman. Her new CD, A Lady Must Live, includes songs by Cole Porter, Kurt Vile, and Billy Strayhorn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Bonnie has slowed down a little bit as it lumbers toward the North Carolina coast. The center reports Bonnie is moving 25% slower, but it says this means Bonnie will stick around 25% longer. Reporter Eileen LeBlanc of member station WHQR reports that some North Carolinians have still chosen to stick it out on the state's barrier islands.
There are about 540 people still on Carolina Beach. Now, that's a barrier island. That's very scary. I also have a report that we have 14 people on Topsail Island. Topsail Island is the little sand spit of an island that took a brutal beating during Fran. North Topsail Island lost probably one quarter of its structures. We are losing shingles and pieces of roofs throughout the county. New Hanover County and Brunswick County are both reporting power outages.
Eileen LeBlanc reporting from Wilmington, North Carolina. Weather forecasters warn Bonnie is likely to curve back out to sea around Virginia Beach. That path puts Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware in increased danger. Meanwhile, more rain is falling on southwestern Texas. Much of the region is already drenched from the remnants of Tropical Storm Charley. More than 500 residents of the Texas border town of Del Rio spent the night in shelters because of the new rain, which created new flooding. One Del Rio neighborhood was evacuated for the second time in 2 days. But Texas authorities are still searching for 41 missing people. They have been unaccounted for ever since flooding poured into Del Rio on Sunday night. At least 6 people have died in connection with the flooding. Attorney General Janet Reno has ordered a limited Justice Department review into the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Reno's decision comes after a request by the King family in Atlanta for a full government investigation. Josh Leves of member station WABE reports.
The review will look into some allegations about the 1968 assassination that were not covered in previous federal investigations. Several people who claim they were witnesses to the crime and a former federal agent say there's evidence that Dr. King was killed as the result of a conspiracy and that the man imprisoned for the crime, James Earl Ray, either didn't shoot King or didn't act alone. Ray had pleaded guilty but soon recanted. Authorities have said these claims could not be substantiated, but the King family and many civil rights leaders have come to believe that the crime was never fully solved. After Ray's death earlier this year, the King family requested a national commission to investigate Dr. King's assassination. The Justice Department's limited review falls short of that, but Reno said she hopes it will provide answers. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
This is NPR. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 71 points at 8,531. The rough ride for Russian investors has meant a rocky session for American investors, NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Stocks dropped more than 100 points shortly after the market opened in New York today, and at midday, the market's mood is not looking much brighter. News that Russian ruble had lost another 5% of its value against the dollar amid a run on banks and a halt to ruble-dollar trading by the country's central bank has investors wondering what's next. While the exposure of U.S. banks to Russia is fairly small when compared to Europe, big institutions like Citibank, Chase, and American Express all stand to lose money under terms of a new Russian debt restructuring plan. It would force debt holders to swap existing ruble-backed securities for longer-term notes. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department reported today durable goods orders rose a surprisingly strong 2.4% last month. Durable goods are big items, things like cars and refrigerators, designed to last 3 years or more. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Associated Press is reporting that Northwest Airlines is close to a deal with its pilots' union. If so, any proposed agreement could avert a possible strike deadline set for midnight Eastern time this Friday. But Northwest is taking no chances. It has sent warning letters to all non-pilot workers, warning them that if they participate in a sympathy strike, they will be fired. Leaders of the airline's two other large unions, the Teamsters and the International Association of Machinists, have not said what they will do. A company that makes papermaking machines is handing out pink slips. Harnischfager Industries. He is cutting its workforce by 20%. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new movie, The Slums of Beverly Hills, Vivian Abramowitz, her father, and two brothers have come to Los Angeles in search of the good life. But they don't have enough money for the good life. The father wants to at least live in a good zip code so the kids can go to good schools. So they live in Beverly Hills cheap apartments with fancy names like Casa Bella and the Beverly Capri. As the film opens, the father, played by Alan Arkin, can't even pay the month's rent on their dumpy apartment, so he rounds up the kids, gets them in the car, and they take off. They narrowly escape their landlord and prepare to move to a new dump.
I'm sick of moving. Why can't we ever stay put? It's not normal to move every 3 months.
It's normal in some cultures. Nomads, they move.
Stupid, Ben. We're not nomads. We are Americans. So where's our new apartment this time?
We're staying in Beverly Hills. It's just too early to show up is all. We want to make a good impression. We want to show up at a leisurely hour. We don't want to look like we just got kicked out of someplace else like bums.
We didn't get kicked out of someplace else like bums. We made a getaway like crooks.
What did you say?
Nothing.
We made a choice. We moved like people. That place was a shithole at those prices. Highway robbery.
Fine.
Okay, who's hungry?
Me.
What do you say we get some steak? Let's get some steak for breakfast.
Yeah. Isn't it a little early for steak?
No, it'll be fun. We'll eat, we'll get our strength up, then we'll move into a new place. What do you say?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Sizzler.
We heard Natasha Lyonne as Vivian Abramowitz. The character comes out of the life of Tamara Jenkins, who wrote and directed The Slums of Beverly Hills, which is set in the mid-70s. She made the film with the help of the Sundance Institute Screenwriting and Filmmakers Lab and Robert Redford, who became The Slums of Beverly Hills executive producer. Tamara Jenkins told me her family had to move a lot because of money trouble.
We were economically disabled.
How'd you
I
get
guess
that
is a
way?
Good word. My dad had he was a car salesman, and he was selling American cars, huge American Fords in 1976. So they weren't really selling so well at the time. There was a big gas problem, and no one was interested in buying those big American cars. That was one sort of issue. And he was an elderly man bringing up this family of kids. And he, in real life, which isn't really explored in the movie except in a sort of like quick way, he had a gambling problem. We spent a lot of time at the track and Hollywood Park and Del Mar and Las Vegas.
What did you think of Las Vegas as a kid?
Well, there's this place in Las Vegas, which I don't even know if it exists anymore, but when we were growing up, there was a you know, casino hotel complex called Circus Circus. They had trapeze artists and stuff suspended above your head and falling into nets. And that was happening above the casino floor. And what they did to sort of entertain the children of compulsive gamblers was they had an arcade of, you know, games. You know, it was sort of like learning how to become a compulsive gambler, where you would like line up and play, you know, various arcade games, you know, pinball-y kind of things, or the sort of things that you'd see at a, you know, on a boardwalk fair way. And so, you know, and you play for sort of chips. So I guess it's kind of training for, you know, compulsive gambling.
Did you like being there?
No, it was a very, I don't know, it was always sort of surreal place to be. I mean, it was, and I don't think I had the sort of awareness that it wasn't the right place for kids to be hanging out sort of around, you know, casinos. It was something that was pretty familiar to me. So I certainly haven't gone back to visit as a grown-up.
In the movie The Slums of Beverly Hills, the father wants the kids to have a Beverly Hills zip code so they can go to good public schools. So he just keeps bringing them to the cheapest places he can find within that zip code. So did you end up going to Beverly Hills schools?
I did.
Were you the only?
I confess.
Were you like one of the few people of your economic class the schools you went to?
There was a sort of a subculture of people that lived there that were poor, and particularly then. I mean, not maybe as poor or different kinds of poor, but there was a kind of there was a lot of the divorce decade. There was tons of divorced people around that period of time. There was the street across the street. We lived at one point on the street called Arnaz Drive in Beverly Hills, and the nickname of it was Divorce Drive because all the kids on the street, you know, the parents, they were broken homes or whatever. And as a grown-up, I thought it was kind of like if there was a Dickens in Beverly Hills, it would be on Arnaz Drive because they were just all these kind of dirty kids running around unsupervised and hanging out on the street. And there seemed to be this whole group of people like that. I mean, we weren't the only ones, but there seemed to be this whole sort of divorce fallout, and a lot of them, you know, there was like a little culture of poor people or sort of struggling people, people that you wouldn't expect to be in Beverly Hills that were living there.
Anyone seeing your movie, The Slums of Beverly Hills, will want to hear what your experience was shopping for your first bra. In the movie, at the age of 15, the main character is taken by her father to shop for her first bra, and he just keeps saying all kinds of incredibly embarrassing things during this already embarrassing experience. And by the time her father takes her for the first bra, she's a size C. She's a C cup. So this has been something that should have been done quite a while ago. So what was your first experience?
Well, I'm sort of verging on a C cup. I think I should tell you that, Terry, because we're not in the same room. But I think that in the case with my father, I had had a phys ed teacher tell me that it was time to, you know, to get harnessed. And she gave me some sort of note, and I had been sort of hiding them, you know. I do recall kind of, you know, submitting this note to my father after school and him, you know, like grabbing me and throwing me into the car as if he was dragging me off to the emergency room, you know.
And what was the experience like when you got to the... Did he take you to a department store?
He took me to a department store, to a lingerie section of a department store. Actually, when and you know, looked for a sales lady to sort of do the dirty work. I mean, he wasn't, you know, rifling through piles of bras or anything. That was in the days that you could smoke in department stores. And I remember him kind of like drifting off through those, you know, those little circle displays of bras and stuff and kind of drifting off to this... by the elevators where there were those ashtrays that connected to the walls and smoking and waiting for me to become finished. But he did sort of have to introduce me. And I think that he felt like it was awkward eventually and drifted off to the ashtray where it was safe.
Natasha Lyonne plays the part of the 15-year-old girl who's at the center of the slums of Beverly Hills. And this character is loosely based on you when you were that age. So what was it like to work with an actress who's more or less playing you? And you're directing her, you've written the part for her.
Well, she is a sort of alter ego character, but she's a much more idealized version than I am. I mean, she's much more aware and conscious and truly a fictional creature. You know, I was really, I auditioned a lot of girls for the role and really fell for her when I met her. And I guess the thing that was the most attractive to me about her was that she was an unfinished person in the best way, whereas a lot of the actresses I was interviewing were very polished and complete people and, you know, really poised and certainly more ladylike and together than I'd ever be. And Natasha had this kind of just unfinished gawkiness about her that I really responded to. There were a lot of things in terms of having her. I mean, I guess the most sort of, you know, there was a lot of work that we did in terms of getting her prepared for the role. I guess the most kind of, you know, silly but true and important part was the fact that Natasha Lyonne has quite small breasts, you know, just naturally. So we had to enhance this. I mean, not because I was, you know, a pervert and wanted an actress with big breasts, but because the role called for a girl with size C breasts. So we had to give her these prosthetic breast things that are sort of gelatinous and pretty real looking. And I guess that was like a big moment between us, which was her coming to a rehearsal, me handing over these breasts to her, her putting them in a bra. And sort of when she first put them on, she was incredibly excited about them because she just kind of got them handed to her. And she said, these are great. I love these breasts. And she was kind of cavorting around the rehearsal studio. And then I said, well, you know, the character of Vivian is kind of has a, you know, antagonistic relationship with her breasts. So go out into the world, deal with life with your breasts, and come back and let's talk about your experience. So she sort of left, you know, breasts flung forward into the universe, and then she came back all concaved and uncomfortable and awkward and sort of hiding her body. And that was a very pivotal exercise. It was actually perfect in a way that her breasts were, you know, because she it was something that she had to just quickly learn how to contend with, sort of the way adolescence assaults you if, in fact, you get a set of breasts or the kind of public nature of female development.
What was it that she found discouraging about having two large breasts? Yeah,
she felt that the world became a predatory place. So she went to grocery stores, or I don't know what she did. She sort of spent the day and said people were kind of, you know, sexualizing her or commenting upon her or, you know, catcalling her in a way that she had never experienced before.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film Slums of Beverly Hills. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film Slums of Beverly Hills. Before you were born, your father ran a strip club?
Yes.
How much did he tell you about that?
He told me very little about it. In fact, I only figured it out because I was doing some investigative reporting on my own life. There was a kind of, I was like this sort of, I became kind of the weird family archivist. And we, you know, the family is very sort of splattered in lots of different places. But I had returned to my mother's house in Philadelphia, and after many years, and started digging through this pile of, like, a shoebox, a classic shoebox of family photographs, and discovered these photographs of a stripper named Blaze Starr.
Oh, a famous stripper.
Yeah, Miss Spontaneous Combustion herself. That's what she was called. And she used to strip, and it's a place in Philadelphia, this place called the Black Cat, where she used to strip at my father's nightclub, and it was on Latimer Street. I think it was on 15th and Latimer. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It does? Okay. It's this tiny club that on 15th and Latimer that he would reinvent over and over and over again into different incarnations because, you know, something would, you know, he had this gambling problem. So he would either blow the sort of income, you know, via his gambling problems, or he'd blow the income via, you know, like problems with taxes or whatever. So every time one of these businesses, which was always a sort of restaurant business, failed, he would reinvent it. So at one point it was a supper club called The Glass Door in like 1948 or something. I only know that because it said 1948 on one of the photographs. And then it was, you know, The Black Cat. I'm probably doing it out of order. And then, you know, he had a sort of Polynesian fantasy kind of tiki, you know, place called the Bali High. And then it was, so anyway, it went through all these various the Mayfair House, which I think was sort of like a classy steakhouse. So he had all of these clubs that he, you know, he'd reinvent over and over again. So anyway, while, you know, digging through this pile of photographs, I came upon, you know, Miss Spontaneous Combustion herself. You got to notice it. And and there was a picture of my mother next to the stripper. And I started doing research into what their life was like because no one really told me. I do have an older brother who was, you know, much more aware of what was going on because he was alive and a grown-up. So I started doing all this research and then found a biography that Blaze Starr had written, you know, via with someone else that had mentioned my father's nightclub. And Rizzo, who, you know, then became the mayor of Philadelphia, used to raid his club because he was police Captain Frank Rizzo, and he would raid my father's nightclub periodically. And my father would go in the paddy wagon with Blaze Starr. I know this is totally off off the subject of the movie, but it was pretty amazing, especially with all that Philadelphia history. It's pretty hilarious.
When you came upon this, did you think, like, isn't that great? My father was such a colorful character. Or did you think, do you think this is really embarrassing? My father ran a strip club.
I think I was kind of blown away by a lot of it. I mean, I was really blown away to find a pink biography by some, you know, like stripper that actually had quotes from my father, these silly quotes like, you know, regarding Rizzo saying that son of a bitch is going to, you know, close down every stripping club in Philadelphia. Don't worry, Blaze. I'll get us out. You know, these kind of insane, you know, in the back of paddy wagons. I guess I was kind of blown away about this history of his, this kind of I wasn't ashamed. I was amazed that he had had so many different kinds of lives. And, you know, and that he had ended up, you know, and that at the end of his life, he sort of, or not at the end, but at the sort of autumn-ish years of his life, he was bringing up his kids on the outskirts of Beverly Hills. He was, you know, a kind of an amazing character.
How did your father end up bringing the kids up after the divorce?
He used to disappear a lot and when we were young. I mean, I must have been 5 or 6 when he totally disappeared. He used to kind of just disappear. And then eventually he'd kind of come back, but I was kind of pre-conscious. I was really young. But then I remember one sort of extended period of time where he was just not around anymore. Like a couple months had gone by. I really think it took a couple months for me to say, Mom, what happened to, you know, Dad? And then she said, oh, he moved away. He went to Beverly Hills, which even to my 5-year-old mind suggested like this amazing, like Oz. I didn't know what it was. I'd never been there. But, you know, through TV or whatever, or, you know, some way I knew that Beverly Hills meant something spectacular and fancy. And I kept thinking it was like Oz. And then not long after he had gone out there, he sort of started sending for us like one at a time. We staggered. One brother would go and then I'd stay with my mother and then another brother would go. And we just sort of ended up out there with him.
Did you want to go?
I think I was pretty, you know, I mean, I was kind of unconscious in a way. I was just in the way that the kids get into a car and they don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden they're being sort of dragged off to another apartment without much explanation. I really experienced life in that kind of kid way where, you know, there was a captain of the ship and they were driving and you kind of just had to go along. With what, you know, whatever. I mean, I guess that's sort of the essence of childhood in some ways, at least for me. It just felt like there were these authorities running the ship and they weren't conferring with me. I was just being taken places.
What was your father's final years like?
He died while I was making the movie, actually. So we had been estranged for a really long time. And it was only when I went out to Los Angeles, because I was flown to Los Angeles to do some work in preparation for the film. You know, we were like, I was meeting casting directors and meeting line producers, and I hadn't talked to my father in many years. And he had been living in this kind of, he had been living with a woman who had essentially been supporting him, and she became ill. And he became ill, and everybody, sort of this infrastructure was falling apart. And, I went out there and he had just gone into the hospital and I hadn't seen him in like, I don't know, over 10 years. And he was in pretty bad shape, actually. And me and my big brother ended up taking care of him and flying him from the West Coast to the East Coast to be closer to us. And we had to put him in a nursing home but spent time with him pretty much up until the end. Except I was making the movie when he died, and so I wasn't right there.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins, and she wrote and directed the new film, The Slums of Beverly Hills. Now, Robert Redford is the executive producer of your movie. How did he get to be that involved with it?
I met Robert Redford I was invited to the Sundance Institute, which has two components. It has a writer's lab and a director's lab. And I had met him, you know, at the writer's lab. It was a winter writing workshop, and it was a couple years ago, and he approached me. It's actually kind of a funny sort of meeting a movie star story, because I was having a really bad, just having a really low self-esteem moment where he was crossing the room, and it was very funny. He we, you know, all these young writers, you don't have to be young, emerging, not everybody's necessarily young, but emerging script writers are invited, selected for, you know, this thing, which is pretty great. I used to call it the Fresh Air Fund for filmmakers, because they'd fly you out of, you know, the East Village or wherever you were living, and you'd go to this beautiful place in Utah, and you'd get to, you know, work on your screenplay. It's pretty impressive. And they feed you and house you, and you're in this gloriously beautiful place. So, Robert Redford's sitting in front, in that kind of the way you'd imagine from like a Sundance, you know, catalog. He's sitting in front of a roaring fire, crackling fireplace, and he's in a ski suit and has just, you know, there's like powder on his shoulders, sort of like, you know, dandruff, but in this case it's snow, and has just kind of taken off his skis, and he's introducing himself and saying, "I'm Robert," as if he needs to. "Hi, I'm Robert Redford, and thank you for attending the, you know, the writer's workshop." And he goes around the room, and everyone's sitting there, and they introduce themselves. "My name is Tamara Jenkins. I'm here with a project called Slums of Beverly Hills. I'm Chris Ayer. I'm here with this project called Smoke Signal." So we're all going around, and the mentors are introducing themselves. "I'm Steve Zalian, blah, blah, blah. I'm a writer, and I'm here as a mentor." So, you know, there was that introduction, and it was very polite. And then afterwards, everyone got up and started sipping, you know, wine out of styrofoam cups, and started. So we were supposed to be milling around, and Robert Redford. I was standing in this little cluster of people, and he started approaching, kind of like heading towards this direction where there was this cluster of people, where I was, and I said, "Oh my God, Robert Redford's coming this way. He must want to talk to somebody here. So I guess I should leave. I mean, I should walk away because he's trying to talk to somebody important, and I don't want to be rude and over here. So I'll just walk away." Like I was, you know, the waitress. And I sort of turned away to walk, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and I swung around, and I went, "Bleh." And he said, what does a New York girl know so much about Beverly Hills for? You know, or some question like that. And I said, and then my self-esteem moment turned into just obnoxious moment. And I said, "Get out of here. You didn't read that. You couldn't possibly have read all of these screenplays that come through here." And then he said, "Yes, I did. I read your screenplay." And I quizzed him on it. And I said, "Okay, so," and he passed the quiz. And he told me that he had grown up on the, you know, I gave him like a reading comprehension test on the script. He passed. And then he told me that he had grown up in Southern California as a pretty, you know, as an underclassman, as a poor person, and used to drive through Beverly Hills and wreak havoc. And he really responded to the material. And that was kind of our first meeting. And then he sicked his producer on me, this man named Michael Nozick, who's a really nice guy who runs his low-budget production kind of company called South Fork. And Michael kind of courted me, and you know, producer wise, and you know, stayed in touch with me while I was working on the script, and eventually I signed on with him.
Tamara Jenkins, she wrote and directed the new film Slums of Beverly Hills. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Papa loves mambo, mama loves mambo. Look at him sway with it, getting so gay with it, shouting ole with it, wow. Papa loves mambo,
Papa loves mambo,
mama loves mambo,
mama loves mambo.
Papa does great with it, swings like a gate with it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a concert and interview with Daryl Sherman. Her new CD, A Lady Must Live, includes songs by Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, Kurt Weill, and Billy Strayhorn. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Daryl Sherman, is a jazz singer who performs at clubs and cabarets and has made several recordings. She has a lovely, warm voice and a great repertoire of songs. On her new CD, A Lady Must Live, which is on After Nine Records, she sings songs by Rodgers and Hart, Kurt Vile, the Gershwins, and Billy Strayhorn. She's accompanied on many tracks by pianist Tommy Flanagan. She previously recorded with pianist Dave McKenna. We invited Daryl Sherman to sing and play our piano and to talk with us about music. So let's get started with a song that's also on the new CD, Cole Porter's I'm in Love Again.
Why am I just as happy as a child? Why am I like a racehorse running wild? Why am I in a state of ecstasy? The reason is 'cause something's happened to me. I'm in love again, and the spring is coming. I'm in love again. Hear my heartstrings strumming, I'm in love again. And the tune I'm humming is the huddle up, cuddle up blues. I'm in love again, and I can't rise above it. I'm in love again, and I love, love, love it. I'm in love again, darn glad of it, good news.
Daryl Sherman at our piano. It's a great song. That song is actually also included on your new CD, A Lady Must Live. You've played recently at the Waldorf in New York, and the piano in the room that you play in is Cole Porter's former Steinway. Do I have that right?
Yes, it was his Steinway that was in the Waldorf Towers, where he lived for many years up until the mid-60s when he died.
Did you feel a Cole Porter vibe when you play his piano?
Oh, gosh, Night and Day practically plays itself. There's a plaque on the piano that kind of commemorates that he lived there and that some of the greatest and most loved songs in America's history were written on this piano, and people come by and they take pictures. I'm in lots of videos. I travel all over the world just from being in these videos and ask me all kinds of questions. Some people want to know if he's going to come down and play. And I say, he may come up and play. And some people even think, I'm Cole Porter. Depends on the age group. Some people ask if he's written anything that they could dance to.
Right.
Get all kinds of things there. But it really is kind of a kick to play the piano, and there's a lot of history just with that hotel.
You got introduced to this kind of music very early on in your life, because your father is a musician. He's a trombone player. Sammy Sherman, is that his name?
That's his name, Sammy.
And he led his own band as well as playing trombone?
He had a combo. I guess that's what they called it then when I was growing up. He played with quartets and quintets. And before I was born, he played with some bands. He played with the Buddy Morrow Band and Sonny Dunham Band. But I was pretty lucky because he would come home from a weekend gig, and I would be the kid awakened at 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning if he'd bring some musicians home and have me sing for the company or something. And
what was in your repertoire back then?
Oh, gosh, I'm dating myself. I think unfortunately, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I think every kid wanted to be Dorothy. He would sit me down at the piano. We had a piano, even though he didn't play the piano. He gave me one of the most valuable gifts by teaching me how to play triads, which is just basically three-note chords, and helping me to accompany myself, because really my first love was singing. He was both my best fan and severest critic. He said, I don't want you being an amateur. You have to know, if you're going to be a singer, you have to know what keys you sing in, and you have to know the terms like taking it out, which is ending the song, or go to the bridge, or go to the release. And he was really strict with me about that, and I'm grateful for it now.
My guest is singer and pianist Daryl Sherman. She has a new CD called A Lady Must Live. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more and hear some more songs. This is Fresh Air. Joining us today at the piano is Daryl Sherman, and she has a new CD called A Lady Must Live. I think one of the things you're interested in doing in the songs that you find is finding songs by women composers.
Not primarily women composers, but it does interest me, women lyricists like Dorothy Fields. But one comes to mind, a lady named Irene Higginbottom. And I don't know a whole lot about her, but I did speak to her once on the phone, and she is the niece of J.C. Higginbottom, Who is a jazz trombonist. Uh-huh. And probably her most famous song is Good Morning Heartache, which Billie Holiday put on the map. Now, that was a collaboration. I'm not sure how much of the music and how much of the words she wrote. But she wrote a whole bunch of other things because she sent me all kinds of music. And a couple of them were written with Nat Cole. And a particular song that I love, This Will Make You Laugh, he put on the map. And I know she wrote the words and music to that.
Would you do it for us? It's a great song.
I'd love to. This will make you laugh. I've staked my dreams on you. This'll make you laugh. They never did come true. I took a chance on the one romance and vowed it could not miss. But I should have known you never judge a heart by a kiss. This will make you laugh. I once believed in you, and for all my
you didn't see it through. Of all the fools, I break the rule. I love you still, you see. This'll make you laugh, but it's not funny to me.
Sung by Irene Higginbottom, played for us by Daryl Sherman. And Daryl Sherman has a new CD called A Lady Must Live. Now, Daryl, an earlier CD of yours was just all songs associated with Mildred Bailey, the singer who recorded in the 30s, 40s, and 50s as well.
Well, not really. She died around 1951. Essentially, she died at age 44 or 45, about the same age that Billie Holiday died. But her main period was in the 30s and the 40s.
Tell me what has made her an important figure to you musically.
Well, first of all, she was a very significant singer in the world of jazz, even though her name is not as well known as Billie's or Ella's or Sarah's. She was a great influence on them, and she was the first band singer. The band in question was the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and it was with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra that she met her husband, the first man to play jazz on a xylophone, Red Norvo. And together they had a great career performing and recording. The significance for me when I finally came to Mildred was, well, first, songs, because I'm passionate about songs. And even in this short span of the 30s and 40s, she sure sang a whole lot of them. And really wonderful songs. And there's something about her. I heard Rosemary Clooney in an interview once mention that she took elegant liberty with the songs, with her phrasing. She was a little ahead of her time. She wasn't a scat singer, but she knew how to phrase and how to make the stuff really swing. And I think even more significant, my relationship to her is she didn't have that stereotypical, traditional jazz sound, the sound that people associate, the sort of husky, bluesy sound. She had a girlish sound, more, even though she was not a soprano, but the timbre made it sound that way. And of course, I can relate to that.
She had a great repertoire of songs, as you mentioned, and a combination of like ballads and swing tunes and novelty tunes. Maybe you could do an excerpt of a couple of her songs, of the songs she sang.
Well, the song that she was most associated with was Hoagie Carmichael's Rockin' Chair. She was called the Rockin' Chair Lady, so I'll give you a little of that. Old rockin' chairs got me, cane by my side. Fetch me that gin, son, for I tan your hide. Can't get from this cabin, ain't going nowhere.
sitting here grabbing at the flies round my rocking chair.
She introduced songs that sometimes became hits for other people. One of the first songs she ever sang was Georgia on My Mind, and of course we associate that with many people, particularly Ray Charles. But she was also great at what you mentioned, novelty songs. And Johnny Mercer was a frequent guest at their home. They loved to entertain Red and Mildred, and he was a frequent guest and brought them all kinds of material. And this is something that she put on the map, and it's kind of a favorite of mine, too. Life was so peaceful at the laundry. Life was so calm and serene. Life was très gay till that unlucky day I happened to read that magazine. Why did I read that advertisement which said, since I rumba, Jim thinks I'm sublime? Why, oh, why did I ever try when I didn't have the talent? I didn't have the money, and teacher did not have the time. Arthur Murray chopped me dancing in a hurry. I had a week to spare. He showed me the groundwork, the walking around work, and told me to take it from there. Arthur Murray then advised me not to worry. It'd turn out all right. To my way of thinking, it came out stinking. I don't know my left from my right. The people around me can all sing a one and a two and a three, but any resemblance to waltzing is just coincidental with me. Anyway, you get the idea.
That's a great song, yeah.
And so on and so forth.
There's another song I'm hoping that you could do a few bars of that Mildred Bailey helped to make famous, and the song is Lover Come Back to Me.
Oh, yes, Lover Come Back to Me is really a favorite of mine, too, and it was Mildred's signature song. She used to end most of her sets with it.
I remember every little thing you used to do. I'm so lonely. Every road I walked along with you. No wonder I am lonely. The sky is blue. The night is cold. The moon is new, but love is old. So while I'm waiting here, this heart of mine is singing. Oh lover, come back to me.
That's great, and that's Daryl Sherman, and she has a whole CD, one of her earlier CDs, that is totally devoted to songs associated with Mildred Bailey. We're going to talk some more, and she'll play some more songs for us after we take a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us at the piano today is singer Daryl Sherman, and she has a new CD, which is called A Lady Must Live, and she's here to talk with us and play some songs. Earlier, we were talking about songs, and you mentioned a song, Isn't It a Pity, that you really love, and you were saying that you hear it differently now than you did when you started singing it, And since you were talking about the important thing being the meaning of the lyric to you, I thought you could tell us a little bit about how the meaning of that song has changed for you, and then maybe you could sing it for us.
Well, first of all, just as I say, growing into songs and finding even a different way with them musically. Sometimes if you change the key, that can change the whole flavor of it. But your perspective at 22 is not the same as it is when you're 42. And in this case, in this song, I think of this as a, more of a middle-aged love song. I happened to sing it just recently. Two friends of mine just married much later in life, and I dedicated it to them, and it had so much more meaning for me now. And then I also think of it in terms of my own life and the people and the relationships that I've just come to. Anyway, and it's also, just in its own right, by George and Ira Gershwin, just a splendid song.
Would you play it for us?
I'd be delighted. Why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme? Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a crime? My journey's ended. Everything is splendid. Meeting you today has given me a wonderful idea. Here I stay. It's a funny thing, I look at you, I get a thrill I never knew. Isn't it a pity we never met before? Here we are at last. It's like a dream. The two of us, a perfect team. And it's such a pity we never met before. Imagine all the lonely years we've wasted. You with the neighbors, I at silly labor. What joys untasted. You reading Heine, I somewhere in China. Happiest of girls I'm sure to be. If only you would say to me, it's an awful pity we never, never met before. Thank you.
the lonely years we've wasted, fishing for salmon, losing at backgammon. What joy is untasted? My nights were sour, spent with Schopenhauer. Let's forget the past, let's both agree that I'm for you and you're for me. And it's such a pity we'll never, never met before. That
was really lovely. Really nice interpretation of that song.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love this song.
Yeah. Daryl Sherman, it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much for
doing
some songs
for us. Well, you make it so much
fun.
It's so great to share these songs with you. It's been an absolute pleasure for me.
Daryl Sherman performing in our studio. Daryl Sherman's new CD, A Lady Must Live, is on After Nine Records. Our concert recording engineer was Audrey Bentham. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth. Ellen, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Let's close with a song from Daryl Sherman's new CD.
If it's naughty to rouge your lips, shake your shoulders and twist your hips, let a lady confess, I want to be bad. If it's naughty to vamp the men, sleep each morning till after 10, then the answer is yes, I want to be bad. This thing of being a good little goody is all very well. What can you do if you're loaded with plenty of health and vigor? When you're learning what lips are for, if it's naughty to ask for more, let a lady confess, I want to be bad.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, war crimes, how they've been defined, and how violators are being dealt with. We talk with Arye Nair about his new book, War Crimes. He's the president of the Soros Foundation and former head of Human Rights Watch and the ACLU. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.